one can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, as we explore tone and the gear that gets it. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Welcome, everyone, to the Flow Guitar Enthusiasts. I'm Scott, and we have Jeff here with me.
Hey, how's everybody doing tonight?
Well, I'm sure they all just said they're doing great. I heard it in unison.
There you go.
But so just for those of you that are just tuning in, just want to remind you, in the middle of the show, we will be announcing the winner of the Audio-Technica package that we're giving away, which is an Audio-Technica 2020 USB Plus microphone and an Audio-Technica M50 studio monitor headphone. So we'll be announcing the winner there in the middle of the show. And then just wanted to talk about, I just posted up on my YouTube a new speaker shootout of actually six speakers from Jensen Speakers. So I've got quite a wide variety there. I've got Alnico, Ceramic, and a Neomag. And I'll be curious to see what you guys think. But the Neomag I thought was the big surprise. I was very excited how good it sounded.
Yeah, no, the technology's there. If they're set up right, they sound pretty good. I have a Weber Neomag that's pretty cool.
And it's super light, so.
Yes.
But we'll talk about that next week with Jensen. So what's been going on with you, Jeff?
A bunch of stuff. I got a bunch of quick announcements because I want to get to our guest. We have a great guest on tonight. First of all, Michael Lamo called and sent me a message. He was on our show. If you want to check out the June 17th show with us with Norman Harris of Norm's Rare Guitars, he was on. He's got a new album coming out, but he just released a new YouTube video called La Cienega. So just look up Lemo, L-E-M-M-O, on YouTube and check it out. It's really good. And one of the songs that he's doing on the album is one of the songs he played on the show, which was kind of amazing.
Yeah, and all of our shows are on iTunes, so you guys can find them on there or on our website, flowguitarenthusiast.com.
That's right. And that show was the June 17th show, so if you want to take a look at that. Also, speaking of Norms, I want to just mention again, he's got an event coming up in January called From Hollywood with Love, concert benefiting the L.A.'s homeless, hosted by Kevin Nealon of Saturday Night Live with Joe Bonamassa, Robin Ford, Grant Guisman, Tony Gala, Kurt Fletcher with band leaders Jimmy Vivino and Jimmy Earl. So that should be really cool.
And Dale Kasher.
Dale Kasher is going to be there. That's right. But they're going to be announcing some more people. I'm sure there's going to be more. So anyway, check out... you can get tickets at the Musicians Institute of Technology. You also check out Norm's site, www.normrareguitars.com, for more information. Third, what I've been doing is I've been playing my Les Paul that was rewired for me by Monique Caravello, and it sounds like a whole different guitar. She flipped the magnet. She changed and gave me the 50s wiring where she changed where the resistors are, and I'll be recording some stuff shortly on that.
Well, because what Jeff isn't telling you is that his guitar for 30 some odd years was wired incorrectly from the factory.
It was out of phase. Yeah. But I actually used the sound. It worked. But, I mean, it was great.
You're the only one that says that it worked.
I know. John Pierre of Incendio mentioned that it sucked and that he just never had the heart to tell me. But anyway, it's a brand new guitar in my opinion. It sounds great. So anyway, I just want to thank Monique, as our new nickname is Grandmo, because she's a grandma now. And so I'll be posting pictures of that and she'll be commenting on that. You can check out Monique at Facebook, Monique Caravello. And you can check out our Guitar Tech show with her and a bunch of great guitar techs on our September 2nd show, 2013. And she was also on the Women in Music show on August 19th. And then also stay tuned. We're going to have more information on a tech school. She's going to be teaching you how to do your own tech work on your guitars, and that's pretty cool. Thirdly, this is directed to our guest tonight, Jim. Bob Bradshaw, I was over by his place, and I got one of his wahs, his custom audio, the one that he makes for Dunlop, the custom audio electronics wah. And I told him who was on the show, and he told me to say hi to you. he said that he had built a pedal board for you before, and we might have to talk about that. So
yeah.
Bob is at customaudioelectronics.com, so you can take a look at that. Now, without further ado, let's get right into the meat of it. It's really a pleasure. This person that we have on tonight was a definite influence in my playing. He influenced me a lot in my style of especially acoustic guitar and electric guitar. And I have the honor of saying I saw him in Poco years ago. So, and it was amazing. He was using a white Strat and I think a twin. So we'll ask him about that in a minute. He started out as an his claim to fame started out as an engineer. He ended up working on Buffalo Springsville's second album again, which was a pretty interesting album. And he ended up producing and playing on the third album last time around. One of the progenitors of country rock with the group Poco, which influenced groups like the Eagles, and there's a whole group of people that came out after that. And then after that, and this was like in a period of like 4 or 5 years, he connected with at that time a little known singer, I think of a folk singer, Kenny Loggins, and set up Loggins and Messina. And the rest is history, because all those guys did some amazing work, and a lot of it due to Jim's brilliance. So I just want to welcome to the show Jim Messina. Jim, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So
made me feel old.
I didn't
realize that much time went by.
Yeah, it's gone by fast. But, man, I mean, just what you've done, and especially even at that time, in a period of 5 years, you went through that's a lifetime of music,
but
right there.
You're skipping the Jester's period when he did surf.
That's right.
That's right, the surf music.
The Jester's was what made it all happen. And actually, before the Jester's, it was the Boutonnieres. I grew up in Southern California, in Hermosa Beach, in Redondo Beach, mm-hmm. in my teenage days, just before high school. So, that was happening in terms of a social situation, and we used to go watch surf films, and in those days it was listening to the Torquays or the Ventures or God, it's been so long I can't think of the other groups the Champs, you can't forget about
mm-hmm,
Tequila.
Mm-hmm.
And about the time I moved out to the Inland Empire into San Bernardino area, in Colton, California, Dick Dale came onto the scene, and that was the first time in my life me and my buddies who were in bands had ever seen an assault rifle on a guitar. the guy was unbelievable. And in those days he played piano, he played trumpet, he played harmonica, he sang well, and he played guitar, and he just had such an influence on us wanting to be in a band. And I think that's kind of where it all started for me. That's when I believed that it was all possible. And we'd go hang out at the stage, and he played so loud, but we'd be standing right in front of his amp, just drooling on the amps and the reverbs and the Stratocasters and the Jazzmasters and the Jaguars. And I mean, I keep forgetting that if it hadn't been for those days, I would have probably never been able to do what I've done. Not so much because of it was Dick Dale, but because it was so inspiring. And I think any person who becomes that inspired by something can really achieve a lot in their life. But not all of us are fortunate to have had that. And I try to encourage my children to feel what inspiration is about, to help them. But yes, that it all kind of began back there in the Boutonnieres and the Jesters and eventually Hollywood and becoming a recording engineer.
Jim, when you were playing in the Jesters, did you actually use a reverb unit? How did you get your reverb?
I did. My first guitar was a white Stratocaster that I bought at a pawn shop down in 5th and Main, and it was so bad and so ugly. I went to Earl Scheib and I asked them if they could paint it for me. In those days, to get a car painted was $29.95.
That's right.
I talked them into painting my Strat for $10, and it's just pearlescent white, and it was bitchin'. It was really cool.
Is that the one that's on the cover of the Jester's album?
Yeah, that's the one that's on the cover. Yes. Which eventually got stolen, unfortunately, but it was a cool guitar.
Because I remember when I saw you, when you played with Poco, you had a white Strat.
Actually, I didn't. I had the only guitar I really owned in that days was a Telecaster, which I still own. It was not white. It was actually kind of blonde, but maybe in certain lights it could look white.
Oh, okay. So in Poco, you used a Telecaster exclusively?
I used a Telecaster. In the very beginning with Poco, I was playing a 6120 Gretsch, but it just couldn't get the tones that I was looking for, which was more of a rockabilly tone, and the Gretsch was great for other things, and so I eventually retired that. And a guy by the name of Rick Kuna, who was in a group called Hearts and Flowers in those days, had bought two basket case guitars, and he made one for himself that he liked, and he gave me the parts of the other one, and I put it together, and it became the Telecaster that I still perform with today. I call it Frank, a nickname for Frankenstein. And it had, we talk about tone, and I think what we forget sometimes, and even with that Gibson that you had that was wired wrong, sometimes it's the accidents that happen that really allow a player to develop a tone that eventually is unique. And we hear about this all the time, and in terms of even genius, when people are somewhat challenged mentally, we've always thought, well, they're not going to do well, but they turn out to be some of the brainiest, most intelligent people we've ever met. And the same thing goes with tone. The guitar had a microphonic pickup in it, and it was an extremely light Swamp Ash.
Mm-hmm.
And the combination of being that light and having a microphonic pickup allowed it to feed back, not enough to where you could really tell right away, but it was feeding back, and it became obvious when I started using a compressor on the instrument, because it would feed back in the room, and you had to get away from the amplifier. But it was that mid-range poppy sound combined with finding the right settings and the right amp to play it through that eventually gave the color and the tone that made it possible for me to, from a tone standpoint, I think, stand out from other people who played a similar instrument, similar amp.
Let me go a little bit in. Let's go back to the very beginning. When you started out engineering, how did you get the gig for Buffalo Springfield for their second album when you engineered?
Well, I was working at Sunset Sound. They needed a second engineer. Bruce Botnick was working there, and I had been working for Audio Arts, which is where Jim Webb used to record his demos, and Madeline Baker owned that studio, and I became their house engineer. And my good friend Mike Durow was the one who got me started in doing engineering. I apprenticed under him, came to me and said, listen, I've been working over at a place called Sunset Sound. They need an engineer, and I can't do it. I want to do other things. Would you want the job? So I went over there and interviewed, and they had just built a new studio, Studio 2, there, and asked me if I would consider it. And I said, well, let me try. And so I went to work there a couple of weeks, and at the time, I think I was like 19. And the board was an English board, and just opposite the faders, instead of when you push them up, the volume would come up. Instead, when you pull them down, the volume would come up. I mean, it was a nightmare learning. It was all backwards. And eventually, they started bringing in clients in there, and they enjoyed working with me. And one day, David Crosby had booked some time there, and I didn't know who David Crosby was. I thought it was Bing Crosby's kid or something, I was totally out of it. And they put me on a session with him, and he was in there doing a demo on a young gal that he had thought was pretty talented. And so we did about probably a good 2 or 3 hours and recorded maybe 12, 14 songs. And it was just an incredibly delightful experience to hear the singer. And at the end of it, I asked him, who's the producer? And he says, well, just put David Crosby down. And I said, and who do you want to put as the artist? And he says, Joni Mitchell.
Oh, wow.
So, the one thing I can say about those sessions was that, very seldom do you actually, especially an engineer, I should say, and especially me, sit down and listen to somebody who's coming in for the first time, trying to get into the business, and have them perform with a guitar and a voice, and just be so unbelievably talented. And I could feel the charisma in her tunes and in her voice and everything that eventually everybody else got a chance to hear. I heard that moment, and that made me a believer that, you know what, talent is talent, and you can try and make it, you can try and shape it, you can tweak it, you can try and pitch correct it or anything you want to do, but when it's there, it's there, and you don't have to do much but put a microphone in front of it and stand back and let them do their job.
Now, when you as an engineer and producer especially for Last Time Around, there was a lot of experimentation. It sounded like, I mean, you could see where their solo directions were going in that album. You know, Stills was going into more of like he had more of a Latin feel, and a lot of what Neil Young was doing on that album, you heard later in his first solo album. You know, what was it like? I mean, as a producer, did you just kind of like try to keep it together, or were you creatively experimenting with them? Were you suggesting, you know, things and certain sounds? Were you experimenting, or did you just pretty much let them go do what they wanted to do?
Well, it was a little and a lot of all of that. With Stephen, he was somewhat impetuous. You know, he wanted something immediately, if not sooner, and turn on the mic before things got, you know, placed. So with him, it was a matter of getting in there and getting things done really quickly so he could, you know, he wouldn't bust his groove. So it made it difficult to really experiment other than just get things in the right place and get things down on tape and then deal with it later. With Neil, he was much more methodic. Neil came in with an idea, and he would talk about it, and we'd talk about how to mic it and different ways of, you know, EQing it, or, you know, whether it needed to be limited or compressed, or, and you know, he was much more sophisticated when it came to you know, approaching what needed to be done. And he was also more like when we did Broken Arrow, you know, he had the ideas that the arrangements and everything pretty much how he wanted them. His question is, how do we make them sound and fit together? And that was my job, to tie them and edit them and do that kind of stuff. With Richie, he really is not a reader. You know, he's a lyric and songwriter, singer, but didn't have very much command over being able to arrange a band or write a music chart or anything. And with Richie, you know, I wrote things out for him. I would hire the players to come in, like on that last record we used Jimmy Carstein and I think it was Carl Rydell, I can't remember his last name, some Leon Russell musicians, because I knew Leon Russell and worked around Leon and Jerry Riopel, so I knew a lot of the players. And when it came to Richie, the other guys would, you know, they just abandoned him. They were pretty much into getting their own things done. Stephen in his direction, as you pointed out, and Neil in his. So now there was the third member there, which was Richie. I had to spend a lot more time in getting charts written and hiring musicians and bringing them in and recording them. And so, like I said, it was a little of all of that. The experimentation for me was having come from working with Mike Durow. I don't know if you're familiar with the name Durow, D-O-R-R-O-U-G-H, but...
Oh, yeah, they're meters. Durow
that's
meters.
Right. That's right. And before the meters, he designed the first multi-band compression, I think up to 8 bands at one point in time.
Oh, wow.
For broadcast radio. And he and I were experimenting with compression and had designed a 3-band compressor when we were working together in the late 60s. And I got pulled off into doing music, and he got pulled off into staying with electronics and became a multimillionaire just in his designs. But he and I were playing with compression and limiting and how to, you know, how to make that more musical. And so when I was working with Springfield, I started, bringing that into their music and trying to help create a little more, you might say, glue to put things together. And with the Carnival of Life album, which was, what is that guy's name? I just had it. But Lee Michaels, we really messed around with compression on that thing, almost to the point where it became acid-y sounding.
Yeah.
and I think they were really into acid, so that really sounded good. Yeah. To them, you know, so... a little too far for me, but, you know, I'm paid to turn the knob one way or the other and advise whether what is advisable. So, but I was experimenting with compression in those days and trying to, you know, get something that was different. Yes and no. Some of the fellas were easier to work with than others. Some didn't really need it, and others really needed it. And Dewey, you know, he was kind of there and not there. And when he did show up, he was a little too inebriated, really, to enunciate and keep a melody going. So that was difficult. They were an incredibly talented group of musicians that were really had different directions, and they were trying to do all of that together. And I think that's why it just didn't stay together as long as it could, because, I mean, Stephen, to me, was one of the most brilliant writers, brilliant players. He was a stylist even in his early days, so much more than other people that I knew of. And so he was very, very inspired and just moving in that internal place a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as was Neil in his way. Neil was just beginning to really open up as a writer and starting to get, you know, when his first album I played on that, I played bass on that album. They didn't give us credit, but it was one of those albums that I could see that Neil was finally finding a place where all of his music seemed to work.
Mm-hmm.
And Richie, well, you know, Richie was a dear friend, and because I worked so much with him on the production side, keeping him, you know, an equal third as a writer in the Buffalo Springfield, that we became, you know, very close. And near the end of the band, you know, when it did finally break up, you know, I didn't, Neil had asked me if I wanted to work with him, and I said I'd love to, and I'm complimented, but I really feel like I'm needed more by, you know, by Richie. And I meant no disrespect to him, but, you know, Neil really didn't need me, and I wasn't interested in being, you know, somebody's engineer. I was more interested in getting back into my own music.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Springfield, I was a bass player in that band. So when Richie and I finally decided, you know, talked about what we wanted to do, you know, I had brought up the idea of, I said, instead of doing folk rock, I said, why don't we try country rock, because I have a background in that, and with Kind Woman and with Child's Play to Fame, you certainly enjoy that. He was a big fan of, you know, several. George Jones was a, you know, one of his singers that he loved, and so that was the inspiration for us to now move forward and try to do something more country rock. You know, Stephen and was kind of bouncing around there for a while, but then when he ran into David and they started working together, and then when Graham came in, I mean, you know, the three of them together at that stage in their lives where they were young and talented and full of just wonderful ideas. Woodstock, for me, the best thing that was happened with that whole video that got produced was hearing those guys sing as a trio. It sounded like a concerto with a solo guitar and three voices. They just musically blew everybody, you know,
yeah,
away.
I remember Joni Mitchell saying that when I guess they used to rehearse over at her house, and it's like, just those three voices, it was magic. The harmonies, they just had that. Those three voices just worked together perfectly.
Yeah, and you know, and their writing skills, Stephen's writing skills, was perfect for that style of music. His guitar playing just really, really, really worked.
Yeah,
they were blessed, and I think they, you know, they blessed the rest of us with some great music, and also, you know, they brought the bar up to where we all had to match that and go further if it was ever going to happen.
Well, I'm going to play a clip real quick. Speaking of Stephen, this is called Questions, and I want to ask you a little bit about what you did here, what guitars, if you can remember what they were using, and also, too, their famous fuzz tone sound. I'm curious what fuzz, because I've heard different stories about what they were using. But let me play the clip, and we'll ask you that. Here it goes.
Thank you.
So can you tell me what they were using? And you were compressing all you, those guitars.
Are you talking about what kind of drugs they were using or instruments?
Instruments.
Oh. I don't know about the drugs, but the instruments. It, you know, it's so distorted in my in my phone here, but let me kind of, from the overtones that I'm hearing, he was probably playing a Martin acoustic. I can't tell whether it was a 12-string or a 6 based on what I'm hearing.
It's the from listening to the original the CD, it was a 12-string. It sounded like a 12-string to me.
Yeah, I'd have to double-check, but it sounds like one over the phone. That particular guitar, I believe, was either a 2-pickup or a 3-pickup Les Paul.
Oh,
so he
wow.
had both. There was a Marshall playing all the lead stuff. I think that was Jimmy Karstein on drums. I don't remember. Do you have the album in front of you?
It didn't have credits on it. I never saw credits on the album.
Oh, really? I think that was Jimmy Karstein playing drums. And then I played the bass on that particular one was a Fender. It was in that period. Again, we talk about instruments sometimes that are weird. It was in that time when they were just coming out with the precision bass,
mm-hmm.
but still had the Telecaster neck on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a big fat neck with a really nice body, and the combination of the two gave an unbelievable amount of bass. And so that bass, from what I recall, is using a Fairchild compressor on it.
Mm-hmm.
To get the smoothness and to have all the notes tie together.
And were you using that direct, or did you use an amp?
No, I was using that direct. With basses, it's almost always better to go direct.
Mm-hmm.
But there were times that I did have a Sun amp that I played with on stage, and I believe I just sat in the control room in Sunset Studio One and plugged that in and played that part, from what I recall.
Okay. And then, do you remember what type of distortion unit Stephen was using at that time?
He wasn't using distortion units. He was just, that was the amp, overdriving.
Oh, wow. That was the amp crank. Oh, wow. That's pretty incredible distortion. That's pretty,
yeah.
That was pretty.
Well, you get the right Marshall. You know, what a lot of people don't understand what a fuzz tone is merely taking one preamp
mm-hmm.
and patching it into the other. And when you turn up the first stage and turn down the second stage, you overdrive it, and the overdriven stage is what is distorted. But because it's coming out at a lower volume than it's going in, the amps on the second stage aren't being overdriven,
mm-hmm.
so you're not hurting anything. It sounds like you are, but in fact, one time in 1970 when I was doing same old wine, I had two BSA 6A RCA compressors in series together, and they compressed down to 60-70 dB. And I was creating some distortion in the first stages, and the chief engineer came in and stopped the session and said, "You guys get out of here." And he goes, "What are you talking about?" He says, "You're destroying those A7s. I can hear it." He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, I can hear them distorting." I said, "Those aren't the speakers distorting. There's an amp in the other room that's distorting. You're just hearing it distorted." I said, "Look at the levels. They're, you know, like there's zero and plus ones. You know, that's not distortion." Well, they tried to shut us down, and finally we had to educate them what the hell was going on, get the union off our rear ends, and finally they... You know, they got egg on their face when they realized I took them out into the studio and there was a little teeny amp out there, and it was just, you know, blasting the hell out of it. But it was going into a, you know, a U67, and it was not that loud, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all fuzz is, distortion is the overdriven preamp. And with the Marshall, you can overdrive the first gain stage on that, and that's how you get that distortion. And then, of course, second stage, you bring up the volume and you can make it loud.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me play another clip from that album. This is a song by Neil. Richie singing, which I always liked Richie singing Neil's songs. He always had a good interpretation of Neil's song. This is On the Way Home. Let me play this for you. Now, that's an interesting arrangement because it sounds like there's a harpsichord or a tack piano in there, and then you have a vibe thing going on at the very end, which is really a nice, cool little color in there. Am I correct? Was that a tack piano or was that a harpsichord?
Well, Sunset Sound, again, it's so distorted, I can't hear it really that clear over the phone. You know, over the phone. But your observation, if it is in fact you're hearing a tack piano, there was a tack piano at Sunset Sound, which was a great sounding piano, and people often used it for, you know, for sounds. It was an upright with tacks on it, and you know, there were percussionists who you know, came in and played vibes and stuff on some of the stuff too. So, I wasn't sure if I was hearing a regular piano and a tack piano, but it sounds to me like it might be just that tack piano and maybe some guitars playing over the top of it.
There's kind of like a string drone. That's why I was thinking of like a harpsichord in there too. But there was like a weird, it could be the way they tuned the guitars. But did Neil was, that was pretty much, Neil was pretty specific what he wanted, or who thought of the vibes?
That would be Neil. That was Neil's arrangements there. He, and he worked a lot with Jack Nitzsche, so I don't know, I'd have to look at credits again, whether or not that's something that Jack helped him with, or if that's something he did on his own. It sounds like something he did on his own because Nitzsche's arrangements were always real tight and real technically orchestrated and, you know, well-honed. That sounds like a Neil's arrangement, and it sounds like him playing the tack piano as well.
Okay. Now let's move on to Poco, because this was where we started hearing more of your guitar playing, and I want to get into a little bit of what you were using at the time. So I'm going to play the title song of the album, Picking Up the Pieces. Here's a clip of that, and we'll get into a little bit of your, what I want to talk about a little bit is your approach in production, how you approach that is different from Buffalo Springfield, and talk about your guitar playing. So here we go, Picking Up the Pieces.
Somebody yell. So let's begin. We're bringing you back down home where the folks are happy, sitting, picking at a grin. Casually, you and me will pick up the pieces.
Now, I just want to mention that the way I edited this thing, I pulled it, it's a little farther into the song, but the reason I cut it there is that the first part that you were hearing in there, if I'm correct, that's you, Jim, playing your guitar, and you're doing all those little licks behind him. And then when it goes around the turnaround and then the verse starts up again, you can hear Rusty doing the pedal steel. And it's interesting because it blends perfectly, and you have to really listen to see what the difference, because I was trying to pull specific pieces of you playing to show you're playing, and it was like, this is just too cool because you're doing this little thing, and then Rusty takes it from there. But tell me a little bit what you were using, acoustic guitars and electric guitars, and can you give us a little background on that?
Well, I have to say first that I was really not happy with Columbia Records. At that time, they gave us an engineer who had never done really even country music or pop music or anything. It was in a terrible transition, 1968, 69, because they were just getting out of the Andy Williams period and moving into, you know, the Janis Joplin period. And it was all new territory for those people over there. And again, it was difficult to get them to understand what, especially myself, I was not allowed to touch the board in those days because I went from working at a non-union shop at Sunset Sound Recorders, which was an independent studio, to working at CBS Studios, which was a union shop. And even though I was an IBEW worker, they had what was called a collective co-bargaining agreement in those days, which part of which stated that an artist could not touch a board, even, you know, even if they were a union member. And I don't know why they did that. I don't know if it was job security or what was going on, but we got handed a bad situation. A nice guy, but just over his head in terms of what we were doing. So that first album for me was a nightmare, and it gave me an ulcer just trying to get the damn thing done. But going back to the creative parts of it all, and you'll notice when you listen to the second album how much nicer it sounds in the same studio.
Mm-hmm.
When I finally had an engineer that I could communicate with and talk to. And we also, when I first started working at CBS there, that's where Amon Erdogan had cut the first Buffalo Springfield album. And they, you know, Amon put the kick drum on one track and all the other drums were on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of stuff I had gotten from CBS trying to put that second album together. It was just poorly done. And by the time I got to CBS and we got into the second album, that's where you have to also understand that in those days, stereo wasn't quite developed yet. You had a right, a left channel, and a center channel, and the center channel was 3 dB hotter than the sides. They hadn't figured out how to make pan pots yet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did create a pan pot, you had to have two pots, and you'd turn one up louder than the other one, and it would force it in one direction. So when I first started working there on that second album, and I'll get back to your question in a second, but that's when I started putting the kick drum on one track, and the snare drum on one track, and the hi-hat on one track, and then using two tracks to create a pan situation so that you could hear a dimensional set of drums instead of this mono blast coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to your first question, in those days, I went from playing the Gretsch, 6120, I think it was, to getting that Telecaster. And I think that first Telecaster was not the one I ended up with. That was a Telecaster that had a part hollow body and
mm-hmm.
part solid body. Great idea, but they were always very thin and kind of nasally to me. I had what I kind of wanted, but not there. But what I was going for in those days was something that probably Buck Owens and the Buckaroos were probably doing at the same time, and that was trying to get the Telecaster and the steel guitar to become more integrated as being able not to tell who was doing what at times so we could create harmonies and have this nice, you know, ensemble happen. Then it would move left and right to where the electric guitar would begin playing, and then, you know, you'd hear the steel on the other side. And we were still, like I said, it was in the beginning of stereo, phonic
mm-hmm,
sound, and
mm-hmm.
things were just starting to bloom. And even the Beatles would end up putting everything on one side, and then, and it kind of felt imbalanced, and it was, or unbalanced, I should say. But, again, we were going through that period of time, too. So the idea there was to try to get camaraderie within the music by us, especially Rusty and I, playing parts together. Then when he broke into playing steel, which was more traditional, then the Telecaster had a real mono kind of sound to it, and now you heard two distinct instruments that could move into playing string parts or just, you know, rockabilly parts. But Rusty and I both had a couple of vibratones that we used later on, especially on album number two,
mm-hmm.
with the peaches or with the oranges on it. And that's where the music sonically started to really, I think, become fantastic. There's some great recordings on there, like Hurry Up. That's on Hurry Up, I'm using the Gretsch to play the solo.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe might be using the Telecaster to play other parts on it. But that particular instrument on that song just really sounded great because it had just the right amount of compression, and the part was real, you know, was bluesy but sophisticated, not just, you know,
mm-hmm.
three-chord blues. But the idea was to try to get five pieces to sound like seven, you know,
mm-hmm.
or eight, and to get the different sounds on the steel by using the Leslie, and I had Leslie too that I would use sometimes, so that when Rusty and I played together, the tones would blend so much you would know who was doing what or where, and then also to then separate out and create that separation, mm-hmm. because with three-part harmony you've got to create space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one and one does not equal two. One and one equals 0.50 and 0.50 because there's only one space that you're trying to share everything with, and so everything becomes divisions until you divide things up to the point where you can't hear certain things because they're not loud enough.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they say two things can't occupy the same space, but with sound they can. But they divide and they go down as
yeah.
opposed to up.
Well, and then what acoustic guitars did you use on those albums? The first two.
In those days, I owned a B-28, in a Martin triple aught, I think it was. Those
two pretty good staples there.
What's that?
Two good staples of guitars there.
Yeah, they were. You know, and then they got stolen from me. Living in Hollywood was a terrible thing if you had instruments, because people would, you know, you just get them stolen. It was just sad. A lot of instruments just went away just because of, you know, the thieves that were living in the canyons in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But I was fortunate enough to have them long enough to be able to record with them. Once Loggins and Messina came, you know, the other thing about doing acoustic music in the late 60s and early 70s is they hadn't quite developed the wonderful pickups like Lloyd Baggs has developed for us in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
Those came many years later. So, you know, you ended up having to have a microphone on your instrument and then on your voice. So the guitar was never really loud enough to be heard unless you were just sitting there by yourself. And if you were sitting there by yourself, then you could have a really great, you know, microphone put on you, you know, a condenser mic or something. But if you're sitting on a stage and other people are playing, you can't use a condenser because they'll start to feedback and they're sensitive to low frequencies and, you know, just a multitude of problems, which is why you don't see them on stages. You know?
Yeah.
That's why Lloyd Baggs makes a fortune selling us something that makes our guitars sound good.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of, let's move on to the next part of the next stage in the game. I'm going to play a clip. This is very interesting. We'll talk again about your guitars, what you're using in your approach in production. This is with Loggins and Messina. And the thing that's kind of cool about this song, and I'm going to play a couple of cuts from there, is the way you harmonize. I presume you're overdubbing the guitar parts. And it's just really, it's a good example of taste. And this first one is Angry Eyes. Let's play this is the intro.
And actually, before you play that, Jeff, then afterwards I'll announce the winner of the Audio Technica package.
After okay.
Perfect.
Here we go.
Time and again, I've seen you staring out at me.
All right, and so before Jim gets and tells us about that track, just wanted to
tell
you...
Well, that track was actually recorded live. Everything was live except for those two little parts you were talking about on the choruses. All that was just... it might have been harmonized, I can't remember. But the rest of it was all cut live in one take. And once we started getting into that second album especially, we just played everything live, and we'd overdub, you know, we'd put a tracking vocal on it, and sometimes we'd keep it, sometimes we wouldn't, but then once the tracks were done, we'd go in 3 or 4 days, do all the vocals, and then within a week mix it down, and the album was done. And it really is the best way, in my opinion, to make records, is to go in prepared, cut it live, because then you get the nice dimension and the feel between the players. And
mm-hmm.
The one thing I really did not enjoy about working with the Buffalo Springfield is they overdubbed almost everything. And the one song that I recall that they didn't, and it's my favorite of all, is Bluebird. That was cut live, and you could just tell the difference between something like that than doing something where it's just fully overdubbed. It's unbelievable.
Hold that thought for a real minute. Scott, go ahead. We have to go ahead and announce the winner.
Yeah, the winner of the Audio Technica package is Jim Lipscomb. There we go. Jeez, McGreece.
All right, Jim.
Jim, so I'll be contacting you via email and letting you know how you will get your prize. So.
Okay, thanks. Now, Jim, I'm going to play another cut real quick. I'm on it because we're almost out of time, and I want to get into... your approach, how it changed with Loggins and in your, especially your production and a little bit of the guitars. But this clip here, that other one too, the guitars were great. And you're hearing it in mono because you're hearing it through your phone, but it's in stereo and there's guitars on each side. And mm-hmm. this clip especially, which is one of Kenny's big songs, House on Pooh Corner, I'm going to play this clip. It's just taste. I mean, I have to compliment you on that. It's just 100% taste. And it's acoustic guitars. You can tell us a little bit about that, but let me play the clip.
But I've wandered much further today than I should, and I can't seem to find my way back to the wood. So help me if you can, I've got to get back to the house at the corner by one. You'd be surprised, there's so much to be done. Count all the bees in the hive, chase all the.
So it's just I just love the interplay between the guitars on there. What were you using on those songs for the Loggins albums and or Loggins and Messina albums? And did your production approach differ? Or you know, I mean, obviously it's much more stereo, but other than that, what was different?
Well, to answer your first question, I was playing a Martin, and Kenny was played catgut string guitar most mm-hmm. of his career, and that was part of what he felt comfortable with. And so knowing that, what I played with on that, because in those days I did much of the arranging, and Kenny was beginning to grow. Kenny was really, his forte was really in vocals and harmonies. He was just, you know, he's always been a great vocalist, and he was beginning mm-hmm. to develop his skills in terms of playing. But for the first couple of albums, he was really just an acoustic nylon kind of guitar player, which is why you hear a lot of that in the songs. And he did it well, extremely well. So on that particular song, it had been recorded several times before I got a hold of it. I think the Nitty Gritty did a version of it, and somebody else had done a version of it. But nobody had ever taken it and put it into the direction that I saw for it, which was to make it more Baroque, make it more classical, make it more ethereal, make it more dreamlike,
mm-hmm.
so that the audience, when they heard the song, could be drawn into it as opposed to pushed away from it, which so many artists push their audience away with the arrangements they create without even realizing it, you know, trying to hide behind this massive sound as opposed to stand out in front of it and welcome people to come through the doors. And so that approach was to look at it from a more classical point. What led up to those days, with the many days and years that I worked in the studios getting up to that point, I had had a chance to work with some phenomenal session players, one of which was Milt Holland, who was a percussionist. And not too many people know this, but Milt Holland was on almost every Poco record from record number 2 that I was on, and then on all the Loggins and Messina stuff, because he was a timekeeper, and he also was an ethnomusicologist, and he would travel half the year to places all over the world, India, whatever, and come back, and then when we'd bring him into a session, he'd say, oh, look what I found, look at this great toy here, look at this tambora, or these bells, finger bells. And when we did Be Free, that part that goes ding, and he has this bell that he hits, and that comes in, and he starts dancing with me with his fingers on the mandolin, and all of a sudden you get the sense of the ethnic distances in the music. You, mm-hmm. Suddenly you could be in Greece, or you could be in Egypt, you could be in anywhere. And for me, my feeling was, in terms of arrangements, was to try to broaden the listener's experience from what they normally hear in the same age group, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Peer to peer, the music we were doing was much more sophisticated than many of the people in our dimension, and I purposely went in that direction, and I'll tell you why. In the Buffalo Springfield, it was folk rock and acid rock, and that already, to me, by the time I got there, was on its way out.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we went to doing country music, I should say country rock music, we were just way too far ahead of ourselves, and the rock stations wouldn't play it because it was too country, they were too biased, and the country stations wouldn't play it because they were too biased. It was too rock for country, too country for rock. And so there was, even though we sold out every concert we ever played at, we just never could get a record played. So by the time I got to Loggins, I said, I'm not going to let this happen to him, what happened to us in Poco.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do different styles of music on every record and every album we make, so that nobody can pigeonhole us. The only difference is we're gonna do the best arrangements and bring in the best songs that we can possibly write. And that was the object, is let's not get pigeonholed here, so that one day if we want to step out onto a stage, someone says, oh, you can't play, that's not your style of music. Well, bullshit.
Yeah. Well, I think that I know that you were ahead of your time at Poco, but I have to thank you, because it put me in a direction that it affected all of my guitar playing, and I thank you for that. We're out of time. It just went too fast, and I didn't even get to cover half of what I wanted to cover. I want to thank you, and that just means you're just going to have to come back. We're going to have to grill you again. But anyway, I just want to mention one thing I didn't get to play. Jim Messina has a new EP called Under the Mojito Moon. It's a Cuban influence with a flamenco guitar, with Jeff Elliott on trumpet, J.D. Daniels on piano, Lorenzo Martinez on percussion, Michael Brady, Chris Polonis on background vocals, and Jim doing guitars, bass, and drum programming. And it's an interesting album. I didn't get a chance to play it, but we will have you back, and we'll have to talk about that and what you're doing now. So. Thank you again so much. Hang on the line, and after we're off the air, I just want to talk to you briefly. And yeah. Scott?
So next week we have folks from Jensen Speakers, and actually we will have them bringing in, I believe, a couple cabinets with a total of 10 speakers. So we'll actually be able to do some speaker demos live on air.
Hey, I have a quick question. The question was about that speaker that you were talking about, that's the light one. What is that? Is that a new speaker they're manufacturing?
It's they call it the Tornado. It's made with a Neomag. So it's I can't say what the name of the element is. Everyone just calls it Neo Mag. It's
Neo Mag Dominium or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be just like Al Nico. It's super light, and a lot of the companies make them. You know, whether it's Jensen or I think Celestion has one. I know Eminence has one.
It's about half the weight of an Al Nico. So like a little combo amp, it's really easy on your back.
Yeah, but I was really shocked. I mean, if you want, you can go check out my YouTube video. But
I will. But I also want to warn you about one thing that we're starting to experience is that they're not letting me take my amps on the planes anymore because they have magnets in them.
Oh,
so
really?
The last couple times I left my amps at home because they were not going to let them on. And I think we're going to have to start thinking. I'm going to try to get a hold of Jensen and talk to them about a style of making an electromagnet like they were back in the 20s when you didn't have magnets. You had to plug electricity into it and make them work. Now, that would be acceptable on a plane because it has no magnetism until it's charged.
Interesting.
So that would be the cool way. And maybe a light speaker, electro-charged, so that we can... take our amps with us.
You should call in next Monday and ask them about it.
Well, you know what? I wouldn't mind doing that. You know, what time are you going to be doing it? 7?
8 o'clock. 8 o'clock. And just let me know ahead of time, and I'll get you on the air on that one.
Well, next Monday, I'll be in Tucson, and I'll be on my cell phone. But let's talk afterwards, because I really want to talk to these guys about it.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Great.
Good night, everybody. Thanks again. I'm going to leave you with Grand Junction from the first Poco album, Picking Up the Pieces. A great interplay between Rusty and Jim. Jim, thank you so much. Everybody have a great week. We'll see you next week, and have a good night.